Welcome to the Social Flight Live podcast, an audio version of our live show, hosted every Tuesday evening at 8 p.m. Eastern at socialflightlive.com. Social Flight is brought to you by Aspen Avionics, Avidyne, Bose Aviation, Continental Aerospace Technologies, Lightspeed Aviation, Massimo MightySat, Tempest Aero Group, and Whip Air. And now, here's your host, Jeff Simon.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Social Flight Live. I'm Jeff Simon. We have a wonderful show for you this evening. Seaplane pilot and retail icon John Nordstrom is here. We're going to talk about his family's history, about flying seaplanes, about the adventure of the Pacific Northwest, and all of the fun stuff that he has done. I cannot wait for you to meet this wonderful, wonderful man. And so, before we get started, just a few things. We've got things just booming inside Social Flight right now. With the holidays approaching, it is so cool to see so many interesting events popping up all over the country and around the world. We have Thanksgiving, Turkey Day, Runway 5Ks, hangar parties, Santa fly-ins, Christmas dances, all sorts of cool things, and it is all in Social Flight. So just go to socialflight.com or get the Social Flight free mobile apps for Apple and Android devices. Check it out, and you can see all of these wonderful events that are happening all over the place. We also have our Destination Digest, which is a personalized adventure planner delivered straight to your email with incredible places to fly, things to do, pictures, reviews, crew car availability. It is all at socialflight.com. And then also, as weather changes and you want to stay in, we've got all the webinars listed and so many educational courses in Social Flight's FAA Learning Center. You can take courses for Wings Credit on demand on your time, anytime you want. If you are a mechanic or you just want to learn about things that the mechanics are learning about, technical topics, then we've got a whole section for AMPs and IAs where you can take courses for the Aviation Maintenance Technician Awards Program or even renew your IA. You can do that by getting your 8 hours of continuing education directly from Social Flight, completely free. You can print out the certificates that you need for that renewal, and also it communicates on the back end directly to the FAA. So it's all there directly within Social Flight. And last, we have our Fly to Win Challenge. We're counting down. On December 1st, we're going to be giving away a Lightspeed Delta Zulu headset. And there is still time for you to enter to win. All you need to do is get the free mobile app for Social Flight, get out there, and just check in at any airport. Then you're entered to win. If you do go to a bunch of airports, you can compete to be on our leaderboard, get extra entries, but even one, and you're entered in to win that fantastic Lightspeed Delta Zulu headset. So be sure to do that. Tonight's broadcast is brought to you by U Avionics and the amazing AV30 multifunction display, the AV20, the Sky Beacon, the Tail Beacon, the Tail Beacon X, and Sky Sensor, all forms of added safety for your cockpit, along with ADS-B. We are building that into this Titan Mustang you see behind me here in our workshop / living room and dining room, and we've also got it going into the Bonanza. So be sure to check that out, and if you do talk to them, thank them for supporting Social Flight and making all of this possible. Now on to tonight's guest. I am absolutely thrrilled that John is here tonight. Since 1901, the Nordstrom family name has epitomized luxury retail shopping. And for much of that time, John Nils Nordstrom has been at the helm carrying on the family tradition. What you may not know is that he is also a very accomplished seaplane pilot with 33 years and over 3,700 hours of flying under his belt. He flies the legendary de Havilland Beaver, two of them, in fact, and making practical use of general aviation in a world where new isn't always better. And we're going to ask him about these incredible vintage aircraft that do missions that pretty much nothing else actually can. And so I am absolutely thrilled to have John here with us tonight. Please welcome to Social Flight Live, John Nordstrom. Hey, John, how are you, sir?
Well, good evening, sir. It's nice to be with you.
Thank you so much for joining us this evening. I think your story, your family story is fascinating, and seaplane flying is just one of those things that I desperately want to do and have not done. And so I'm really excited to dig in here.
Good for you.
If you could take me back a little bit, I want to start with your family story going back to your grandfather because it's really quite fascinating. And I don't think a lot of people know about it, and I think it speaks to you and the ongoing family tradition. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, he was a Swedish immigrant that could not came to this country, couldn't speak English, and somehow ended up out in California. And he and his Swedish buddy read that there was a gold rush in Alaska. So away they went. They got a horse, they got an old freighter, and they went up to Skagway. And yeah, I think everybody would kind of identify with these guys that didn't know anything, hardly could speak English. And they're going to go get their gold in Alaska.
Literally a freighter and a horse.
Yeah, and when they got Skagway, they have big tides there, and it was low tide, so they just pushed all the horses off into the water, and the horses swam to shore, and they had to go to shore and find their horse. So there's horses running all over the beach, and they had to find their horse. So that's how they got started. It wasn't really very organized.
Wow. So what happened after that? What, how did it turn into
Well,
the
they made a trek up Chilkoot Pass in the snow, and I'll be darned if they probably should have died, but they got into the interior of Alaska, and John W. made a claim, and of course the guy he made the claim with was going to sue him and all that kind of stuff, so he settled for 30. I think it was $32,000. So
Oh.
he got $32,000 to bring it, and he and his shoemaker buddy made their way back to Seattle and started a shoe store.
Wow. And that was the shoe store that started the chain?
Yep, 1901. The First Avenue was a dirt road, but they opened their shoe store, and by gosh, here we are today.
Man, that's a heck of a journey to that. So tell me about your kind of like growing up in the family business and what it was like and then getting to take over.
Yeah, my dad and his two brothers took the store from, say, 1920 to 1930, and then we came along, and the three of us, my brother and my cousin and myself, took it over from there. So it was kind of shoes only when my dad's group had it, and then we bought a ladies' apparel store and made us a specialty store out of it. So that's kind of what my brother and my cousin did in all in those years. And we had, and I shouldn't say we had a falling out, but we had a little disagreement with the old generation. We were planning stores, one of them down in Southern California, and they wanted to make that store 80,000 feet. We thought it was going to be too small for that market, so we wanted to make it 120,000 feet. And so it was a little bit of a disagreement, but the young guys won. We made it 120, and it was still too small.
Wow. And what was it that I guess you're known for luxury, high quality, high customer service. Was that a tradition coming up, or did you take that on yourself to have that?
My brother and my cousin and myself decided that the competitors, Neiman Marcus and Saks, and there's a whole bunch of them out there, really gave pretty poor service. They'd give maybe to their cherished customer, they'd give service, but to somebody off the street, not very nice. So we said, what we're going to do, we're going to compete on a customer service basis, and we don't think our competitors are going to be able to match us. So we went to work, and everything we did, everything was built around customer service. We didn't talk about necessarily sales, profits, all that kind of stuff. We wanted a clean store, but the main thing, we wanted our salespeople to give fantastic, fantastic customer service, and we rewarded them for it.
Mm.
So that was kind of the basis of the whole thing.
And it sounds like it was no matter who the customer was.
Oh, well, and there's a lot of good customers out there, believe me. And you just want to do whatever you can to take care of them. And it frankly, between you and me, it was easy. It was too, because our competitors were so bad. It was really easy.
That's fantastic. So one of the things that I love about your personal story that I'd like to share with people is that you actually discovered flying a little bit later in life than many people.
53,
which is still young, but
no, I decided I wanted to do this, and if I was ever going to do it, I had to do it now, and I did. So what I did, you've heard of Kenmore Air, most seaplane pilots have.
Yeah.
Kenmore Air was started by Bob Monroe, who was a mechanic at Boeing, and he helped build B-17s. And so he, when the thing's all over, he goes out to the north end of the lake, and he has a shop repairing Seabees. You know what a Seabee is?
Yes, sir. Yeah, the old Sea. Yeah, you don't see Republic Seabees.
And finally, he didn't know how to fly, but his partner talked him into learning how to fly. So they started doing charter flights in Seabees, and then they bought some Norsemen. You know what a Norseman is?
Dr. Brent Blue, who has a Norseman, is this enormous, big plane.
Great big fabric airplane. And so they had Norsemans and Seabees. And when the Beavers became available, Bob snapped a whole bunch of them up, surplus, and his shop refurbished them. At one point, I think he has as many as 12 or 14 Beavers flying all summer long and most of the winter. And they'd fly right by our house, which was interesting. We lived on Lake Washington, and I could hear the Beavers go by our house on their way to Lake Union to pick up passengers, and one right after another. And pretty soon I could, you know, the noise of a 985 is spectacular. That's the very best piece of airplane noise in the industry, is that 985 chugging along. So finally, Sally and I and the kids decided we wanted to take a charter flight from Kenmore to my parents' boat way up and halfway up Vancouver Island in Canada. And I was a little nervous because I really hadn't done much float plane flying. So we jumped into the Beaver, whole family, and away we went. Stopped in Nanaimo for customs and kept going north. And my parents' boat was anchored. We went over, dumped us off. My parents jumped in the Beaver and went back to Seattle. And I said, man, that was spectacular. But then after that, we came back to Seattle, and Bob Monroe was sitting in his office one day. I walked in and I said, Bob, I'm going to talk to you about maybe flying a little bit. And he said, oh, really? And somebody came through the door and they said, John Fluke has just canceled his airplane. He had a brand new Beaver on order and he just canceled it. Oh my goodness, Bob was kind of devastated. So I looked at him and I said, how much is that Beaver he just canceled? And he said, well, with whipline floats and a brand new Beaver avionics, the whole thing, $400,000. And I said, you know what? If you teach me how to fly it, I'll buy it. So I bought the airplane. I didn't know how to fly. he had three 172s on straight floats that he gave lessons in. So there I go. I'm out there taking lessons in a 172 on straight floats. And I got my float rating, but I did not know how to land on a runway. My airplane's an amphib. And so I had to get one of the guys to show me how to land my own airplane on the runway. So Mark McIntyre, who happens to now be the head pilot for Bill Gates, gave me my instruction in the Beaver amphib. So there you have it. That's a short story, but that's how I got indoctrinated.
How wild is that? And And it was really like kicked off by that adventure to Victoria Island. But at the same time, this, I love that this was like this is meant for transportation for you, right? Like that's the magic carpet.
It was to our Hood Canal summer place, which is about a 25 or 30 minute flight toward the Olympic Mountains. And it's about it's a tough 2 hour drive on Friday afternoon, but it's a 20 minute flight. So we would leave the Beaver on our dock. We'd load it up with all our stuff. Away we'd go, and 20 minutes later we'd be there, and I would attach the Beaver to the buoy.
That's awesome.
We'd swing around out there all weekend.
And the cool part about that is that with seaplane flying, if you're as like you, where you're living right on the water, you don't even have the step of get to the airport. That's it.
No, we didn't have to get in the car. All we had to do is get a push cart and get our groceries in the plane, and away we went.
That's fantastic. I love that. Very, very cool. So what are some of the other kind of adventures that you've done around the specifically with floats first?
Well, on floats, unbelievable. Before I was able to fly tail draggers, we flew the Amphib down to Santa Barbara. and of course, it's pretty slow. You're at about 90 knots and 95 knots all the way down, and lots of drag with those floats. But we landed at Santa Barbara Airport and put it in the hangar, the FBO. And this is just kind of a little side story, but we got to know Steve Stafford, who is own Studio Wings, and they provide aircraft for the movie industry.
Mm-hmm.
And he told me that Harrison Ford and Ivan Reitman, the director, were going to make a movie called 6 Days, 7 Nights.
Oh, yeah.
It's about a pilot who crashes out on the islands and so forth and so on. And they were going to use a Cessna 185 for that movie. And so I said, well, why don't you have Harrison and Ivan Reitman come up and take a look at my airplane? Maybe they'll switch to a Beaver. So they did fly up one day and looked over the Beaver, and Ivan said, yeah, we're gonna do Beavers. We're not gonna do the 185. So that's how the Beaver got up in that movie, 6 Days, 7 Nights.
Is coming to see yours. That is so cool.
Yeah, coming to see mine. And I said, you want to use mine? So, oh no, we're gonna beat the heck out of those airplanes. We don't want to use yours.
That's fascinating. Very, very cool.
Now, they ended up buying 6 of them.
What?
Yeah. It's owned by Disney. They bought 6 of them, had them all painted up the same, and left one as a wreck on the beach just to take pictures of. And they had another one was a wreck in the woods just to take pictures of. And the other 4 were actually flyable.
That's fascinating. Wow. I guess you don't know necessarily what goes into a movie, but it didn't occur to me that they would buy 6 planes, 2 of them be wrecks.
Yeah. Jeez. So that part was kind of fun.
That's very, very cool. You actually cross paths with quite a few people. Tell me about your connection with Kenny G, who's also been on the show. And Kenny flies, of course, a Beaver, and talked a lot about that and his love of the plane. Tell me about that.
Well, Kenny only flies that Amphib. I told him, what you got to do, Kenny, you got to take the floats off and make it a tail dragger. If you're going to fly that thing all the way to the East Coast, which he does every summer, you can't. And you got to get an autopilot. You didn't have an autopilot. Otherwise, you just kill yourself going across country with that thing, flying it, hand flying it the whole way. Well, he for some reason he was afraid to get his tail dragger rating. I don't know why, because a Beaver tail dragger in my opinion, a superb airplane.
Your first when you first got your license, you didn't even have your tail wheel, so you had to get your tail wheel after you owned it.
Yeah, after I had about a 1,000 hours. We switched to. So I got my tail dragger rating, and that wasn't easy. Flying a tail dragger you know, it was a lot different than a regular amphib. And so I got pretty good at it after a while, but boy, that thing was a wildcat.
Was your actual training to learn how to fly tailwheel in your plane, like learning in a Beaver?
Oh yeah, in the Beaver. Yep. And that I got better and better and better at it, but you know, the center of gravity is in front of you. So it does want to spin. If you make a mistake, it does want to go round and round and round. And thank God it never happened to me, but I can feel it could happen if I made a mistake.
Wow. So tell me a little bit about seaplane flying. It's kind of interesting from your perspective, since it was your primary trainer, basically. I mean, in was seaplanes. Tell me a little bit about that for those people who are generally land pilots.
Well, land pilots, some of them fly IFR. I never flew the Beaver. I have a rating, but I never flew the Beaver IFR. Mainly in a float plane, what you're doing, you're staying underneath whatever that ceiling is. So the ceiling's 500 feet, you're flying along at 400 feet. And as long as you can see 2 or 3 or 4 miles ahead, you kind of just keep going.
Because you can stop, because you have the luxury of being able to stop somewhere.
Well, yeah, if you get in trouble, you land, and then you got to taxi in and find yourself a safe harbor. Every landing is completely different. Wind, tide, the tide's a big factor. Waves, of course, and the direction of the waves, the speed of the wind. So you're landing, every single landing is a challenge. And the most dangerous landing in a seaplane is glassy water. Because what happens is if you don't do a glassy water landing, which setting up way high and let it sit, try to fly in normally in a glassy water, so many pilots have just stuck it right in the water and killed themselves. Glassy water is, always do a glassy water landing. Never, ever don't do a glassy water.
Interesting. Definitely. That's definitely very interesting. Had you sailed before to know kind of the waves and the winds and that
side? No, I'm not much of a sailor, but speaking of sailing, you know what sailing is in a seaplane?
Tell me.
I don't expect you to know that.
No, please tell me.
If I come into Kenmore and there's a strong south wind and I land in the south, Kenmore air is behind me. I can't, if the wind is strong enough, I can't turn the plane around. The minute the plane goes halfway, the tail won't let the airplane go all the way around. So you got to go in backwards. So you leave the engine running very slowly. You pull the water rudders up. You open the doors. You use the rudder to steer the airplane backwards toward the dollar. And I've had that happen to me a few times, which is interesting. One time, I think Jimmy Graham was in the classroom at Kenmore on the second floor, and they were instructing sailing in a seaplane. And they looked out the window and they said, "Oh my gosh, it was me. Here comes a sailing plane. Let's watch and see how he does." Luckily, I got the thing tucked in between the dock just about right and didn't bang up an airplane. So that was kind of fun.
So you're like going backwards and just...
You go backwards slowly, and the way you steer it was with your air rudder.
Wow.
With the water rudders, you pull them up so they're not a factor.
It's fascinating. Also, you mentioned Jimmy, right? He was on the show just recently, Jimmy Graham, who was played for the Seahawks and the Saints and so many other teams, Chicago. And it seems like there's this really, really wonderful community of seaplane pilots because all you guys know each other.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Oh, no. And it was so funny because when he came to the Seahawks, Pete Carroll said, "You got to get him going on your airplane." So I did. I called him up. "Jimmy, come on, let's go flying." And from then on, we did a lot of flying in my plane. That's, you know, he's 6'7", and I couldn't get him in the seat. The seat was too small. He couldn't get his legs in there. So luckily, one of my airplanes has military seats in it, and it was set up for parachutes. in the seat. So I took the back cushion out and put a little dinky back cushion in, and we gained about 3 inches, and then he was able to fly it just fine.
Oh, well, you definitely sold him on it. I mean, I remember him saying that he sort of had to keep it secret from the team a little bit. He didn't want people knowing that he was there flying.
That's right.
That's interesting. So kind of flying in itself is this wonderful community where everybody, you can talk to any pilot, and we're all happy to talk to each other and be a community. But the seaplane pilot community is even smaller and more concentrated, and you seem like some just wonderful people around the marina.
Well, you all end up in the same coves, the same harbors, and you end up at the dock together, which is kind of nice. In the Seattle area, there's the San Juans, and there's quite a few really neat little harbors up there. And then the minute you go to Canada, there's tons of them all the way up to Ketchikan. So there's tons of places to fly on the inside of Vancouver Island.
That's so cool, because like you can really, yeah, there's a lot of adventure to it. That's for sure. Yep. And I love the fact, as you mentioned, you, of course, everybody can live with their plane if they're fortunate enough to have waterfront property or on a place that can actually do that. Kenny told me a funny story that he took. He said that the time he titled it something like the time that he got the most respect for Kurt Russell. Kurt Russell was at the Legends event that we've all been at, and he was flying with Kenny, and Kenny was, I think, thinking about showing off a little bit and thought maybe he could make it into his dock when the wind was pretty strong. And he came in, and then all of a sudden he realized it was not going to work. The angle was totally wrong. The plane is coasting in. And so he just told Kurt, like, stay here. I gotta go save my plane. And the engine was stopped. He opened the door. He dove out to get in there and to keep the floats from hitting. And he dove in front of it. Well, he looks over, and Kurt Russell, he dove out right with him and was on the other float.
Oh, my gosh.
And he'd never flown before. He was just sitting there right with him. He looked over. He's like, oh, I love you, man.
I hadn't heard that. That's a good story.
That's a unique world of, like, have you had some cool stories of flying in to places where you had to pull up to not a dock or something interesting?
Oh yeah, you got to be careful there. Those rocky shorelines and when there's a lot of pilings under the water there's just a ton of really big problems if you're not really really know what you're doing. And if there's rocks sticking up maybe 6 inches below the surface, you could tear a hole in your floats. Mm. So scouting out where you're going to land, try to fly over it once, look at it, look down, see, try to find the best way, see where the wind is blowing, see if there's any logs that you could hit, a whole bunch of stuff like that. And you got to really be careful as you approach the dock that your angle with the wind and the current, by the way, current trumps wind.
Really?
Yeah, current trumps wind. So you had two things going on there. You got a factor for to get into the dock, and then you got to get somebody to grab the rope and put it around the cleat so you don't disappear.
That's very interesting. Now, tell me a little bit about some of your travels of where you've taken. Now you have, well, let's start with the planes. You have two Beavers. So tell me about them.
The only difference, they're virtually exactly the same. One has a three-bladed prop. The other one has a two-bladed prop. The two-bladed prop is the old-fashioned way that most Beavers were fitted out. The three-blade is quieter for the neighbors. So when you take off in Lake Washington with a two-blade, you're creating a pretty healthy noise profile. But the three blade is quite a bit quieter. However, the two blade has more pull and more guts, and I like the look of it. I like the Hornet a lot better than the three blade.
A lot of people don't realize that even though more blades kind of like looks cool or looks sexy, that really it's fewer blades. Like two blades is more efficient, is more powerful, is more, you know, gives you, you know, that more speed, things like that. And even at one point in time in history, if you go to some museums, there actually existed one blade propellers with a weight on the other side.
Crazy. I don't understand that one.
Yeah, I'd love to see that one go. I've seen it, but I've never seen it run on an airplane.
No, I know.
What year are the planes?
One of mine is a 57 and the other is a 64. 64 is one of the last made, and the other one's made about halfway through the run. And they made 1,500 of them.
Really? There's only 1,500 Beavers?
Yep, and they sold them 1,000 of them, 500 to the Army and 500 to the Air Force.
Wow, interesting. I, you know, it's interesting to me that they are such incredibly capable planes that, as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, they serve a role. They fulfill a mission that other planes can't do, really.
Even all the new ones can't. Isn't that amazing? And that 985, as you know, was first run in 1929.
Wow. that's amazing. I'm surprised no one's come up with anything to take its place. That all there is rebuilding them, I guess.
Yeah, there's the Husky and the Kodiak and, you know, on and on and on. But there isn't any airplane that fulfills what the Beaver does.
Wow. And how many people do yours hold?
Well, when it's on amphibs, I try not to put more than about three or four in, but we can take eight people in the tail dragger. It's got a 2,000 pound useful load, the tail dragger.
2,000 pound useful load.
Useful load, yeah.
And you have it done with what, three rows or how many?
Yes, three rows, three people in back, three people in the middle, and then a pilot and co-pilot.
Oh, so it's three across.
Yeah, three across. That's how Kenmore used their charter planes. They fill them up. They put eight people in them all the time.
Do they use 985s? Same thing.
Yep.
Wow. And then I think I've seen. So tell people you mentioned where Kenmore got started, but tell people a little bit about what Kenmore Air actually is now.
Well, now they have about 23 airplanes, and most of them are actually single turbine otters. Mm. And the single turbine otter, they evidently is a big money maker. So they have acquired those from everywhere. I think they have like three or four Beavers left, a couple of Cessnas, and they have an amphib. I can't remember.
To the twin otter, I know that. Do they have any of those?
No, they don't have a twin otter. That's too big. That's too big an airplane for them. Mm. Actually, when we take the floats off of ours, Sally and I take the tail dragger down to Oxnard Airport in California. Mm-hmm. It's about an 8 or 9 hour flight. We usually stop once, stay overnight, maybe in Medford or someplace like that. And then we go on down to Oxnard, and then we have an avocado ranch in Santa Barbara, actually Carpinteria. So I did a lot of flying out of Oxnard, all over Southern California. I took a group of golfers out to Death Valley once. There was four of us and our golf clubs, and of course lots of fuel. And we went out there and played 18 holes of golf. And they have fuel out there, nice hotel. Death Valley, and came back and seemed to work fine. The Beavers handled it just fine, and the nice thing about it is that there's a ton of military airspace between Oxnard and Death Valley. So you spend all your time dodging that military airspace to get out there, but it's kind of fun.
And what's it like flying Death Valley?
It's nothing. All of a sudden, you're flying along and whoop, look down there, there's something. Oh, there's a runway. So we landed and played our golf and came back. It was fantastic. And then Sally and I went, just two of us went out one day, and I can't remember when we went to lunch or whatever we did. But then we came back and it worked out great. We loved it. But I've been in a lot of those small airports all around Southern California in the tail dragger. And the fun part is you land, and of course there are no beavers down there at all in California. So you draw a crowd. All of a sudden you land and shut the engine off, and here come all the pilots. They want to know about the beaver.
It is a big plane.
Yeah.
It is definitely. As a matter of fact, I'm going to show a couple pictures here to show people what that's actually all about, because I love it. Do you have any kind of nicknames to know which one you're doing?
this one is 233 November. Let me move it out of here. I can't see it, but let's see how do I do that? I can see it.
Oh, that's okay. We have, but this is the red and white 233 November.
Yeah.
And then
see that next one is what?
Well, I'll go back to this one. You were going to tell me a little bit about 233 November.
That is the two-bladed prop, and I bought that in Ketchikan, and a charter company had been flying German fishermen from Ketchikan into those lakes, and the airplane was really beat up. It had a plywood floor. It had Chevrolet seat belts, and had about 15 holes in the panel, empty holes. But for some reason I fell in love with that airplane and bought it.
This was the second one. This wasn't the first.
First one is the blue and white one. That's 456. And you should come on a picture here pretty soon. Is that the one hanging off the lift in Kenmore?
Looks like it's on the lift getting ready to get put in the water.
In Kenmore, yep. That's how they launch their airplanes at Kenmore. Lift them up with a forklift.
So this was the one you learned how to fly on?
It is, yep. That's when I paid $400,000 because the other guy canceled the order.
And they what's on the side of the floats? It looks like there's.
I can't see.
I guess that's just built into the floats. Maybe those are.
Let me see if I can get it.
No. That's okay. So now we've got the a picture up of 233 November's panel.
Oh yeah, that what I did. A lot of guys like to kind of trek up their panel. But I like the traditional panel. This is the original panel that you're looking at here. I like mine to look exactly like it did when it came out of the factory.
I like that. I like how classic it is, and yep. It's rugged. I mean, you look at that that center stick and.
Yep, and it is really a. Really neat to have that classic old panel in there, and you can put the 530 and all that kind of stuff in, but I try not to do anything that takes it away from that original look.
Yeah, I definitely like that original look. Now there's what's fuel management like on a Beaver? I see that there's a big red knob to your left on the panel.
That switches the fuel, and you got three belly tanks and two wing tanks. And on a long trip, like I do when I go to Oxnard, you fill all three bellies and you fill both wing tanks right to the top. So you got 130 gallons of avgas in there. And you start out and you burn the center tank out almost empty, the front tank. Excuse me, I meant the front tank. and then you drain the wings into the front tank, and you drain them completely. So there's nothing in the wings. So you have nothing to worry about as far as weight out there when you're landing. And then I burned the front tank out first, and second in the middle tank, and the rear tank is the smallest of the three. So that if you can land at your destination with pretty good shape in your rear tank, that's pretty safe.
Mm. Got it. So you're basically emptying that front one, like you said, and then you just drain? It just drains from the wings in?
Gravity drains the wings into the front tank because the tank is under you, under your seat.
So do you have to choose left and right, or do those just come together in?
What I did, you can select both.
Mm.
So that both wing tanks will drain at the same rate, and that works pretty good.
That seems like a lot to manage, five tanks.
Well, remember, you're not going very fast.
That's okay. I mean, I've got two. I guess people who have wing tanks have four.
Yeah, five tanks on a long trip, but it works great.
That's really wild. I just it's so utilitarian looking, and I love the throttle quadrant that's way up high in the center.
Yeah, Bob Monroe told me, he said that when you take off your at 36 inches, and that's your throttle's about 3/4 of the way up when 36 inches at sea level. And if you get in trouble and you need more power, he said, just shove it all the way forward. You can't hurt the engine. So even if it goes to 39, 40 inches, no big deal. Can't hurt it.
Wow. So is that because those are obviously turbocharged then to do that? And
Oh yeah. It's not turbocharged. It's something else. What do you call it?
Supercharge.
Yeah. Yep. There is a charger in there somewhere.
Tell me about the 985, because that is really a very, very cool big radial classic engine.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I ran mine about 1,100 hours and then put a new engine in. And that's what Bob Monroe told me to do. He said, after 11, you're going to start having little dings, little valve and a little something. Don't do it. Just put the new engine in. And I did, and it seemed to work great. That's a great engine. Very heavy.
How much does it burn per hour?
Oh, when I'm at cruise and I'm in the tail dragger, probably in the low 20s.
Hmm, that's not bad.
Not too bad. Not too. And your tail dragger, you're doing about 115 knots. So it's quite a bit faster than the amphib.
But you're hauling, as you mentioned, 2,000 pounds of useful load.
Oh, I know. That's something.
I mean, that's the key. When you're talking about a fuel burn, it's about it can either be speed or it can be what you're hauling. And in this case, it's what you're hauling.
Have you got any other pictures? Any other pictures there?
Yeah, let's see what else we've got here. So I've got one of both of them out at the dock, which is really kind of cool.
Whoop, did I lose you?
Nope, they're right there.
Hang on. Now, what that is, I want to tell you what that is.
This is both of your planes at the end of a dock.
And that's our summer place. That's a floating dock, and that's salt water, and the tide raises. It's about 14 feet between high tide and low tide. So that dock was completely dry. And so that's this is arriving at our summer place. And my son-in-law, Stephen Ratzlaff, flies one of the airplanes, and he's instrument rated and loves to fly the Beaver also.
Oh.
So in those days, he flew the blue one and I flew the red one. And we would land and spend the weekend at our summer place.
That sounds absolutely wonderful. And then this is a busier dock.
That's Kenmore.
So this is Kenmore.
That's the Kenmore dock. So their planes are all out flying, and I'm just there getting fuel.
And then this has you basically beached there.
That's our beach in front of our house, and that's low tide. And you can see that the airplane is on a buoy. See a little buoy sticking up there in the
yeah.
Let me see here a second. Yeah. And so the floats are sitting in the mud right now. It doesn't hurt anything because it's the bottom is muddy. But that's our buoy. And that's the lowest tide of the year right there.
Wow. That's wonderful. And then we have you and Jimmy.
Jimmy Graham. Yep. You see he's taller than I am.
Just a little bit. That is very, very cool. I absolutely love that. So when it comes to, I guess, you've done both. Obviously, seaplanes where you started on this. Tell me a little bit more about like cool places you've thought of that when you think about where you've flown or cool adventures that you've done.
Oh boy, that's a really good question because most of the really fun we're in the tail dragger down in Southern California. We went out to that airport that's right next to Edwards Air Force Base.
Whoa.
And let's see if I can remember the name of it. And we taxied in, and somebody came out and they said, well, you can land here, but you can't get out of the airplane. Oh. So we
Is
looked
it
right.
Mojave?
No, give me that again. Oh, yeah, that's it, Mojave. Yeah. Yep, that's it.
Where Burt Rutan and the whole spaceport is.
They wouldn't let us get out of the airplane. And I guess that runway at Edwards, we looked at it from the air. It looks like it's about 2.5-3 miles long.
Wow.
And it's completely flat around there. So I thought that was kind of interesting.
Kind of doesn't matter where the runway ends at that rate.
I was shocked that they wouldn't let us get out of the airplane.
Ooh, that is very, very cool. Any other kind of?
I'll give you one more. Harrison and I, we with our wives went to Mexico. So we took off from Orange County, and we went to Ensenada, Mexico. And landed, and evidently, I guess he'd made a hotel reservation. So we went to a hotel, went out to dinner. That was interesting, going out to dinner with him in Calista. So we ended up in a really Mexican restaurant where we were the only non-Mexicans as far as I could tell. So nobody recognized him or disturbed him. And so we get out, we're going to walk back to the hotel. Oh, that was a mistake. All these Americans were in their rental cars, and they'd go by, open the windows, and they're, oh, yeah, Harrison, come over here and give me a hug, and all that kind of stuff. And we thought, oh my God, that's awful. Well, for him, it was kind of normal. So we ended up finding a taxi cab, went back to the hotel. And then we went to another town that's on the, forgotten the name of it, I should know it, on the top end of Baja, the Gulf of Baja, in a gorgeous little town. And we had lunch there, and then afterwards we jumped in our planes and came back home. Going over the border in those days was a lot easier than it is now.
That's so cool. Now Harrison, he owns a beaver. Did he get that after you showed him?
When he made the movie, he decided he had to have one of his own. So he and I went out to Kenmore, and he bought a brand new one out there, had it painted the way he wanted.
And now, when you say brand new, you mean that they rebuild them? Kenmore rebuilt them.
You looked at it, it looked perfect. Yep. Perfect paint job, perfect everything.
You have sold a lot of beavers in your life.
That would be true. Yeah, that would be.
I'm realizing even right now when you say Harrison Ford, Kenny G, Jimmy Graham, and I think the list goes on and on from there.
Well, I got some more. I can't think of them right now. Yeah, Barry Schiff.
Well, Barry, of course, shout out to Barry and to Brian, good friends of both of ours.
That's right.
That
also, I gotta tell you, and this is really fun for me, but my grandson, his name is Nils, N-I-L-S, that's my middle name, and he has taken to flying, and he's fully checked out in the Beaver, and his aspiration is he wants to spend a little time as a Kenmore pilot, and then maybe do something like a charter pilot. So he has, he's done a spectacular job of getting going on the Beaver. He's 26, I think he's 26.
That's wonderful. How cool is that?
The family keeps going.
Yeah, you're going to keep these in the family. I mean, it's a good thing you bought two.
Well, you know what? There have been times when I've said, well, I don't need two. Which one should I sell? I couldn't make up my mind. I like them both the same. It's like your kids. I like them both the same.
Yeah, you can't do that. So,
no.
So tell me then, is there a connection then between the way that you approached your business and Nortr? Obviously, you're in sales. You've sold so many Beavers like we just talked about. There's got to be some connection between how you view your business and how you view your aircraft and Kenmore and all your friends.
Well, I never tried to sell a Beaver, but some of my friends, as we've talked about, they have the same feeling that I have. They just got to have one. It's a whole different feeling. I've never had that about a 185 or a whatever, or even a turbojet. The turbine Beavers is a big drop off from the 985, in my opinion.
Yeah,
big drop.
You know, I also think there's something to be said for these classic aircraft that were built so tough for both military purposes and others. I think people feel the same way about like Navions and things like that. Yeah. They're just so tough and so iconic. They never go away. You just view it as, of course, it's always going to be here.
That's so true. Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. And the nice part about the Beaver, what, were you still there?
Oh yes.
Okay, I got to get you back here. What did I do?
Oh, the window probably just went away. That's okay.
Here we go.
There you go.
There we go. Because you know, and most of the guys that I have gotten close to in flying have the same feeling about the Beaver. They really do. It's an airplane you kind of fall in love with. And when they designed it perfectly, in my opinion. And anything that breaks, it's easy to fix. It's like a Model T Ford. You can fix it almost yourself. I've got a couple of things that I actually fixed myself when I was a long way from home. And felt good about it.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about maintenance, because even though it's such a monstrous aircraft, I have heard that it's really manageable.
Yep, we take it apart once a year, put it all over the floor, and put it back together again. But the only thing we ever find is a little corrosion in the tail from the salt water. So we try to keep that flushed out with fresh water. But if we do that, boy, the airplane, it's amazing how tough it is.
Yeah, and I can say as a mechanic that there is something to be said for the whole kind of stout aircraft thing, because there's a downside in many aircraft to taking them apart every year for annual inspections. When it's built of lighter sheet metal, when everything's a little bit less stout, every time you're taking one of these screws out, every time you take one of these bolts out, you wear it more, you open it up more, everything gets a little more stressed. So it almost feels like you're damaging the plane every single year when you do that. And yet, when I've been exposed to real classic, amazing aircraft, there was the boys and I got to do some maintenance on B-24 at one point. When you're looking at these old, like World War II era and after aircraft, their castings, they're huge pieces, they're heavy gauge metal. The act of taking something apart and looking at it and putting it back together does nothing to it.
No.
Absolutely.
The nice part, they did that, and they could have made the Beaver out of lighter weight metal, but it wouldn't have been the same, I don't think.
Yeah.
I really don't.
Yeah, it wouldn't have lasted.
Wouldn't have felt the same. When you tap on the cabin, you know you're tapping on a Beaver.
All right. Well, John, we have come to the part of the show where we like to do something called Social Flight's Fast Five, which are five questions that we ask of you, just personal, like about your flying and things like that.
Good.
So you game for that?
I am.
Okay. John Nordstrom, this is your Social Flight's Fast Five. Five questions to learn a little bit about you and your flying. We're going to start with question number one. As someone who started on seaplanes, which is so rare, and then went to tail draggers and land-based aircraft, how would you personally describe the difference or your love for one versus another?
Well, my first 72 hours were in ACE. 172 was straight floats. So I did all my stalls and all that. Deep turn, all that stuff in a float plane. And to me, it felt, the 172 really, really felt good. I love flying that airplane. So I'm kind of glad I didn't start on a runway. When you land a float plane, you got to keep the nose up. Got to keep the nose up, 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 up. And so after you've done hundreds of those, you always keep that nose up as you're landing, and you'll be just fine.
Excellent. So that's a really good way of kind of thinking about it. So seaplane wins every time.
yep, absolutely.
All right. Question number two. Was there some type of either like scary or impactful moment in your flying history that you learned something from?
Oh, that is. I'm sure there's a bunch of them. Let's see if I can think of one. Impactful.
Well, I know Sally has stood, you mentioned earlier, stood by your side through pretty much any landing, whether it was good or not.
Well, we went up to some friend's place on called James Island. It's owned by Craig McCaw. And of course, he's a big pilot guy. And when we were landing, I could not, we were going to land and spend the night with, I could not find a place to land that wasn't in jeopardy from wind, current, waves, other boats. And we flew around. Finally, I found a little sliver down by the harbor. And I told Sally, well, we're going to give it a try. And by gosh, we got it down. And we put the wheels down and taxied up the ramp, and I thought, whoo, I didn't know what I was going to do. Go to Victoria Airport and land. I didn't know what to do. So that was an unusual thing for me, not knowing where to land.
Hmm. Well, it's a good thing you had the other options. That's the nice thing about amphibs.
That's right.
Yeah, you've got both. Okay, question number three. If you had the opportunity to go back and just re-experience some really wonderful memory of flying, one place that you could just kind of just go back and re-experience again, what comes to mind?
Ooh, that is a very good question. One of the things that we did when we had the plane in Oxnard, I'd go down and get it, and I'd get it ready, I'd take off, and I'd fly it over to Camarillo, and we would go to the Waypoint Cafe for lunch with a whole bunch of pilots, and Barry and Brian being two of them, a whole bunch of good guys, pilots, on Friday at noon. And I got so I really, really thought that was really special, that I could be included in that group. And I'd fly the Beaver over and leave it out in front so everybody could see it. And of course, everybody, and that was, to me, that was really, really heartwarming and fun.
I am so thrilled that that was your memory, because I have to tell you, I think it was 2 or 3 years ago, Barry invited me to that same cafe on Friday at noon with that same group. And it was one of the nicest things I've ever experienced. So I'm right there with you, and shout out to Barry for that.
Yeah, and the conversation, I didn't want the conversation to end. I didn't want the lunch to end. It was so much fun.
Okay, question number 4. If you could go back and give some advice to your younger self, go back and say something to your younger self in your teens or 20s, what would be your advice be?
Well, I, teens or 20s, advice. Oh, find a job that you just love and that you're good at. Find a job that you're just, my job in the store, I thought it was just great. I loved it. And I was pretty darn good at it. And I knew I was good at it. And so it kind of kept me charged up. But, you know, retail was 6 days a week, and we had 55,000 employees, and you know, all those things that can go wrong. And boy, I'll tell you, our company and our employees did a fabulous job, and they made my job easy.
Wonderful. All right. And our last question number 5. If you could choose anyone, alive or dead, past or present, from history or current, anywhere, anyone to have dinner with, to spend an evening with, who would that be?
Ooh, ooh. That is, yeah, let's see. Well, you probably know this, but we owned the football team in Seattle for 14 years. And I was the managing partner for 4 years. And I met a lot of good guys, but one of the guys that I just thought was really neat on another team was Don Shula. And I kind of got to know him from owners meetings, NFL owners meetings. And I thought he was really something. I'd love to have dinner with him.
Oh, that's wonderful. Don Shula of the Miami Dolphins. How wonderful is that?
Yep. Yeah, he was much fun.
Well, John, thank you so much for taking time out of your evening tonight to join us here on Social Flight Live. It's truly been a pleasure, and it's so insightful. I love learning about seaplanes, your family's history, and so many things that make our world so small and really quite wonderful. So I'm really grateful for you taking the time to join us.
Well, you did a good job of getting it out of me, I'll tell you. Thank you.
You're very welcome. I hope we get to spend a little time out there. Maybe I'll get to hang out the seaplane base with you at some point.
Sounds good. You betcha.
All right. Have a wonderful, wonderful evening.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for doing this.
Good night.
Good night.
And thank all of you for taking time out of your evening to join us here on Social Flight Live. We'll be back next Tuesday, that's December 3rd at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, with General Lloyd Fig Newton. That's right, he is the amazing 4-star general from the United States Air Force, retired, who served as commander of the Air Education and Training Command from 1997 to 2000, also the first African-American pilot to fly in the United States Air Force Thunderbirds, and flew, I believe it was over 300 missions in Vietnam in the F-4 Phantom. This is when the Thunderbirds were flying the Phantom. This is not a show to be missed. He is a truly amazing, spectacular individual, and I cannot wait to share him with you here on the show. And then Tuesday, December 10th, we are actually back with our Cockpit to Cowl show with myself and Brian Schiff. To register for that show, you go to cockpit2cowl.com. That's with the number 2, cockpit, number 2, cowl, cockpit2cowl.com. And you can register for that show. And this is a fun time where Brian Schiff and I hang out. He represents the pilot, the flight instructor, the commercial pilot, and I talk about it from the mechanics perspective. And this time we're going to talk about winter is coming and all the things that people need to do when it comes to winter flying, winter maintenance, you name it. We'll be tackling all of that on Tuesday, December 10th. Until next time, I wish you all a wonderful, happy Thanksgiving. I hope you and yours stay safe and have a wonderful time just enjoying the holiday. I'll see you next Tuesday, and I wish you all blue skies.